And this morning we're continuing slowly, I hope, and hope as clearly as I can, to look at this new experience of contemplation. John of the Cross calls it the night of the senses. Don't immediately jump to think of night in any negative sense. The night is actually can be quite beautiful. And we'll talk about that in a few moments' time. Night of the senses. I think what John of the Cross is saying, Teresa doesn't use the term, but they're saying the same thing, is that, yes, when we're meditating, our senses are involved. We did a meditation the other day at the pool of Bethsaida. And we can picture the scene, we can listen to the words that Jesus is speaking. We can, and as we see and listen, at times emotions arise, prayer arises, and thoughts and feelings of adoration and wonder and gratitude and sorrow, and etc. You're familiar with all of that. Well, what John is saying is that when contemplation comes, when there's a gentle movement inwards, when the direction of the prayer is shifting from what we're doing, beautiful as it is, to what we're receiving, beautiful as it is, then we go beyond the senses. We all know you cannot see God. That's clear. When we go into contemplation, we can't see anything. So our senses, our memory, our imagination, which are clearly linked to our senses, they're not functional in this inward drawing, maybe momentary, maybe 5 minutes, maybe a quarter of an hour, maybe longer, who knows? Depends on where we are. So that's what John is talking about here, and I'll try and unpack it as best I can. The difficulties that we encounter in the early stages of contemplative prayer, till we're at home with it, might cause us to wonder if it really is contemplation that we're receiving from God. Could it be, we wonder, and understandably and perhaps correctly, could it be that we're caught up in distractions of our own making? Because of some infidelity or carelessness. And that's why we can't imagine or feel. Are we losing our faith and our fervour? It's here more than anywhere else that we need the sure guidance of recognized masters of the spiritual life, Teresa and John of the Cross. Edith Stein, a Jewish philosopher who became a Catholic and was captured by the Nazis and killed dreadfully. Anyhow, she's in a book written called The Science of the Cross. She writes this. John of the Cross writes for contemplatives whom he wants to take by the hand at a definite point on their way, at the crossroads where most of them are perplexed and don't know what to do, because in the way they have so far pursued, they're suddenly confronted with insuperable obstacles. On the other hand, the new way that opens before them leads through impenetrable darkness. Who would be brave enough to enter on it? The two roads in question are those of meditation and contemplation. And she continues, so far, the hour of meditation has been devoted to exercising the powers of the soul. perhaps according to the Ignatian method. We've used our senses, our imagination, our memory, our understanding and will. But now, these refuse to work. All efforts are in vain. The spiritual exercises, until then a source of interior joy, now become a torment, unbearably and arid and ineffective. It's not always like this, but it may be. On the other hand, there's no inclination either to take interest in worldly things. We want to pray. We'd like best to be quite still without moving, letting all the powers rest. But this seems sloth and waste of time. This roughly is our state, which God wants to introduce into the dark night. And she's mixing up correctly two things, the night of the senses and the night of the spirit, which we'll come to in a day's time. So in general, the darkness of this prayer, because we're being drawn to God and God is beyond all our senses. So it's totally expected, really, and understandable and good. But we don't know quite what's happening. We're wondering why it's drying up our normal prayer. John of the Cross offers, and you might like to check this later with your spiritual companion, or John of the Cross offers three indications by which we can test our prayer to discern whether it is indeed our responding to this gentle drawing inward, this gift of contemplation that's causing the change, or whether what we're experiencing is in fact the result of our infidelity. So let's look at the three signs, and maybe at greater leisure later you can check this. The first sign that it is contemplation and not just a dryness because of our distraction and whatever, the first sign is when we realise that we can no longer meditate or use our imagination to reason. There's no longer any pleasure in doing so, but only dryness. I'll add, and I hope correctly, we're talking about when contemplation comes. When it's not, of course we can meditate and take pleasure. We're not suddenly changed into a whole new world. But there are moments that are different, minutes that are different, time that's different, another kind of prayer. And that's what he's saying. When that prayer is granted us, or when we're open to that drawing inward, then we can't use these faculties. Continuing the quote now. When they've exercised themselves for some time in the way of virtue, when they've been faithful to meditation and prayer and freed themselves from attachment and love for the things of the world, they have at last gained some spiritual strength in God. By this strength, they're able to hold in check the desire for creatures, and they are able to endure some hardships and dryness in prayer without longing for that better time when they felt more taste and enjoyment in spiritual practices. And John continues, then this light is turned into darkness, night. The door is shut, and the source of the sweet waters of the Spirit is blocked, from which they had till then drunk whenever they wanted. Now they find themselves in darkness, so that they do not know where to turn with their imagination and their thoughts. So he's describing his experience. Teresa is the same. It might be yours. It might be at times yours or mine. The second sign, so the imagination isn't working and the memories are not working and the feelings are not there that go with those. That's one sign that it could well be contemplation that we're experiencing. The second sign is an awareness of the disinclination to fix the imagination or sense faculties upon other particular objects, exterior or interior. You genuinely want to pray. You genuinely want to be in prayer. You genuinely want to respond to God, and you're disinclined to do something else. And John says, look, I'm not affirming that the imagination will cease to come and go. Even in deep recollection, it usually wanders freely, says John. But that the person is disinclined to fix it purposely upon extraneous things. So meditation isn't working, but we don't want to go anywhere else. While we no longer find pleasure in meditating, we also find no pleasure in focusing on anything else apart from God. The lack of pleasure in other things indicates that our dryness doesn't come from infidelity or chasing after other pleasures. John assures us that the fact that we're upset that we find little relish in prayer, we used to find some relish, now we don't, and we're upset by it, he says that's a sign that the dryness doesn't come from weakness or from being lukewarm. For it is the nature of being lukewarm not to care greatly for the things of God. But in all honesty, you know you do care. That's why you're troubled by not seeing and imagining and feeling and whatever else. And the third, says John, and surest sign that it's contemplation and not just a dryness because of living a distracted life, the third and surest sign is that we take pleasure in being alone and wait with loving attentiveness upon God. You can't see God, you can't feel God, you can't imagine God. You're taken into a strange place, but you do want God and your loving attentiveness is there. Without making any particular meditation, in inward quiet and peace and rest. Because God is drawing us into a communion that is beyond our natural powers of understanding, we must journey in faith. And the whole of the next presentation will be on faith. We must journey in faith. John of the Cross speaks of our senses being in darkness, of course, because they've gone beyond what we can sense. We're in touch with the mystery of God. This includes our imagination, memory, and understanding, which rely upon our senses. Back to Edith Stein. Rather lovely. The word night has many resonances, and she'll give some of them, and I think quite beautifully. And by no means are they negative. She points out the rich symbolism in John's describing the lack of pleasure in these sense faculties as night. On the one hand, night envelops us in and all things. It threatens to swallow us up. See if this is true, what you think of when you think night. What it hides is still there, but is indistinct, invisible, without form. It impedes movement and paralyzes our faculties. It induces fear. It condemns us to solitude and a foretaste of death. But on the other hand, night softens and smooths what is hard, sharp, or crude. It reveals subtle features that are lost in the daylight. It drowns out the noises of the day. It quietens the spirit, freed from the busyness of the day, and gives deep and gentle repose. So it is with the mystic night of infused contemplation, which arises from within. There's a lot to ponder and feel there, and there are pleasures enjoyed by our senses which do not flow from this profound centre of communion. On the contrary, these pleasures distract us from our deepest yearnings. Some pleasure comes from feelings that lack the purity and clarity that is there when our emotions are fully tuned to our deepest longings. Such pleasures are transitory. They fail to satisfy us because they distract us from the heart's deepest longings. We can find it hard to resist giving in to them, and they can continue to attract us even when we are in communion with the one for whom our heart longs. But someone has to assure us of that, or we might think we've done something wrong. We may have too, but we may not have. This is partly for the pleasure, however superficial, which they give us, and partly because they distract us from the pain that is part of growing, and the demands of the inner journey, and of the truth that such a journey reveals. There are many impurities in our desires, and until they're purified, fired, pure and fire is the same word in English, P-U-R-E and F-I-R-E, they're the same thing, just different spellings because of the way words have developed. So purified means fired. There are many impurities in our desires, and until they are purified, they're a distraction from and an obstacle to communion with God, to which grace is drawing us. Unpurified desires, weary, check this for yourself, weary, disturb, darken and defile us. Like the tossing sea that cannot keep still, its waters toss up mire and mud, and there's no peace. That's Isaiah. They afflict us and they keep us bound. Our feelings can keep us bound. John of the Cross makes it clear that unpurified desires are a problem. This is so important. Unpurified desires, we all have them, are a problem only when they're voluntarily entertained. We should not be worried about feelings and desires that are part of our nature and that happen without our wanting them. There's no need for these to disturb us. It's terribly important, but subtle, like all of this. We don't want them, then they're not going to just let them go on with it. If we're looking for them and wanting them, that can be the problem. Here's John of the Cross again. I'm not writing here, he says, of natural desires, which are not voluntary, and of thoughts that do not go beyond the first movements, and other temptations to which we're not consenting. For these do not produce any of the evils that we've just mentioned, he says. For although when we experience in them we may think that the passion and disturbance which they're producing are defiling us and holding us bound, it's not the case, he says. So it's a matter of wanting here, intention, attention. In earlier reflections, we looked at many of the things we can do to discipline our senses, our feelings and our emotions. Here, we wish to look again at what happens when we begin to respond to God in the first experiences of contemplative prayer. The fact is that ultimately we cannot purify our senses, our feelings and our emotions. Only God's love can do that. So now, when we begin to experience these gentle movements inward, change of direction of our prayer, now we must hand everything over to God and focus on responding as humbly and faithfully as we can to whatever discipline God is gracing us to undertake. We're to learn to look to God in the dark and wait on God. In offering us the sublime gift of contemplative prayer, God is offering us what our deepest spirit ultimately desires. What used to give pleasure to our unpurified senses, imagination and emotions gives pleasure no more. Our feelings may rebel, but God is granting us an immense favour. God is offering God's self to us, beyond the senses and the imagination and the memory and feelings. God is offering God's self to us. We shouldn't be surprised that whatever is not God loses its appeal. Even in prayer, we can no longer arouse feelings of devotion the way we used to. Thinking about the mysteries of faith, something that used to give us consolation, now, in these moments of contemplation, doesn't work. They leave us dry and distracted. We can no longer achieve a sense of quiet communion with God the way we used to when we were doing the prayer. This is because God is weaning us off such attractive but not yet fully purified pleasures. God is drawing us beyond the limits that we can attain by our own efforts. God wants to take us where our hearts wish to be, but where we cannot go while we are holding on to the control of our prayer. Holding on to control of our prayer is a wonderful thing to do. And we might spend most of our life doing it. So we're not saying anything negative about that. We're just saying when you experience this perhaps bewildering, perhaps not, change in direction of your prayer, a lot of other things will no longer satisfy us. And we've got to let them go and trust that it's God who is drawing us. The lack of feeling in our prayer can be, it may not be, but it can be painful. But we're learning an important lesson about our limitations. We're learning humility and reliance on God. We're learning to live by faith. Any experience of pleasure is now recognized as a sheer gift of grace, However, for the most part, we will not experience any pleasure at all. This is because something very precious is happening in the depths of our being, and God doesn't want us to be distracted from what's happening. If we're unused to living at this depth, we'll miss the more surface feelings, and for some, at any rate, this can be quite painful, bewildering. But once we see, with the help of Teresa and John, that it's actually a very beautiful journey we're on, and that the dark is actually quite wonderful, because that's where we've gone beyond our limited apprehension of the divine into the divine, then maybe all this pain can stop pretty quickly. Depending on how much we need to be purified, and that'll vary from person to person, and how much courage we have to allow this purifying to take place, we may find ourselves in this arid place for a long time. We can be sure, however, that God will always graciously offer us the strength we need to endure. Paul writes, and including this topic, that no testing has overtaken you that is not common to everyone. God is faithful, and we'll spend the next presentation looking at that. God is faithful and will not let you be tested beyond your strength. But with the testing will provide the way out so that you may be able to endure it. The way Jesus endured the agony, the scourging, the crowning with thorns, the journey to Calvary. But in all that process and crucifixion, in all of that enduring, he was at peace, he was in contemplation, he never doubted his Father's love. He was in profound prayer. Each person's experience here will be different. Some of us will experience more consolation than others. This may be because we're already so humble and unattached that we readily surrender to love. We're happy to let the reins go because we trust. On the other hand, it may be because we have not the courage to go through the purifying fire of love. And so God meets us on the surface where we're used to meeting. We forfeit the attraction to the depths because we're afraid to explore them. They reveal something about us. We don't know what they're going to do because we're in the dark. If we are to enter into full communion with God, and no one here doesn't want to do that. If we're to enter into full communion with God, we have to be weaned off surface feelings of consolation. And we have to surrender our reason and live by faith, however painful and bewildering this process may be. I haven't had this present experience, it just flips into my mind now, but a lot of you would have. You love your children. Well, on the 10th night of whooping cough, when you've had no sleep and you got to care for the little darling, well, you get out of bed. Hope you take it in turns, but anyhow, you get out of bed and you care for the child. And that's so loving. But I don't know your feelings would be that good. They may be, but they may not be. Because you're not loving to feel loving, you're loving to love. We'll be encouraged to continue along this path if we recognise that it's precisely God's love, here's the point, that's taking us into the deep and dark recesses of our own soul, where our senses may feel nothing and our understanding is unable to guide us. Since we cannot see God, we must long for God in the darkness. Marie Eugène, in the one of the two books he's written on Teresa of Avila, I'm a Daughter of the Church, writes, see if this makes sense to you, this secret, peaceful, and loving infusion from God, which is contemplation, liberates the spirit from its subjection to the senses, following how you feel. And it calms the senses themselves little by little in this night, thus permitting us to have free and peaceful commerce with God, who communicates God's self to us through the gift of the Holy Spirit. One of the main graces, and we're talking about the beginnings of this contemplation, one of the main graces of this time is growing in true humility through knowing ourselves as we really are. Humility is an extraordinary virtue. When I was doing my own course in Rome for the Licentiate of Scripture at the Biblicum, I decided I'd do one of my major theses on humility, because I thought I'd actually don't know much about it. I've known one or two really humble people, probably more, but I didn't recognise it. But when you meet someone who's really humble, it's quite mysterious and wonderful. In any case, so I did this. Now, what I discovered was that the word humility, tapenophrosune, is Paul's word, the first person in Greek to ever use the word is Paul of Tarsus. I found that astonishing. And I went to the professor and he said, oh, no. And he looked at it and he looked at the evidence. He thought, he hadn't noticed it. Well, I only noticed it because you can't find it in the Greek dictionary. You find the word tapenos, which means low and not high. But tapenophrosune, means is to think of yourself as low. Unless you become as a little child, you cannot enter the kingdom of heaven. And why is Paul using this word? Because Jesus was humble. Now, the whole of the Greek world rejects that in their time. There were three, they may not come to mind now, but they might. Josephus was one. Epictetus was another, a teacher in Rome. And I think the third one was Plutarch in the Delphi. They use the word tapenophrosune after Paul, but it's always a vice. You're not supposed to think of yourself as low. That's having a low self-image, we might say, which is not healthy. And that's all they could see in this tapenophrosune, is people think, no, you're supposed to assert yourself, you're supposed to become something, you're supposed to acquire virtues. V-I-R, of course, means man in Greek. So virtue is a thing that men do, real men, acquire virtue. It's all baloney, but anyhow, that's what their world was. So this extraordinary, it's the only virtue in the New Testament that only Jesus has. And those who he lives in. I found that stunning and quite amazing. And obviously I didn't intend to say anything about it, but it's mentioned there anyhow. Growing in humility is becoming like a little child and recognising, of course you think of yourself as low, because look at God, look at the world. And if we approached everybody the way Jesus approached the woman caught in adultery, for example, he got down on the ground with her. He looked up to her. That's lovely. No one's ever looked up to her before. He did. Naturally, if you might say. Because he had this extraordinary virtue of being a child. Knowing that everything comes as gift. Well, contemplation is a gift. It's not something you can do. try hard as you like. If you think you're doing it when you're trying, well, it's not contemplation. Now, this is a gift, and it's coming from God. And the simpler we are, the more we welcome it, the more we won't have all these troubles that some people have and that John's trying to help them get through. So one of the main graces of this time is growing in true humility, joy at being a child loved by God. John of the Cross writes, "We see ourselves so dry and miserable that the idea never even occurs to us that we're making better progress than others. We're not thinking that. As we believed ourselves to be doing before, if we were silly, and we can be. You might have thought, probably you didn't, but some people might think they're praying better than they used to or better than other people. And having said that, let's get rid of it because it's such a silly thought. But if you ever had it, you haven't got it now. It's all gift." John of the Cross again. "Softened and humbled by hardship and other trials, we become meek." It's a beautiful virtue, meek. I think Shakespeare attaches meekness to the king. Meek means it's gentle but strong. Like, you have to have both for meekness. Real gentleness is very strong. It's not putting silly wrong kind of humility. Meekness is having strength but using it gently. And gentleness is a great sign of real strength, as you know. People who are punchy and pushy and self-assertive need a lot of love because they're actually quite weak inside. "Softened and humbled by hardship and other trials, we become meek with respect to God and to ourselves as well as to others. Now we're no longer angry with ourselves. We're no longer disturbed," writes John of the Cross, "because of our own faults. Nor are we disturbed with others because of theirs. We're no longer displeased with God because God doesn't quickly make us holy. These times of dryness, lack of feeling, lack of imagination, lack of sense attachment, these times of dryness, therefore, cause us to journey in all purity in the love of God, since we're no longer influenced, as previously, in our actions by the pleasures and enjoyment of the actions themselves." You know how we can all love the feeling of loving. Or do we love? They're not the same. Nothing particularly bad about it, but they're not the same thing. We don't love to feel loving, we love to give ourselves to another. So we're no longer influenced as previously in our actions by the pleasure and enjoyment of the senses, which were okay in their time, but only now by the desire to please God. We're surrendering ourselves in love, in contemplative prayer, but since God is not an object of unmediated human experience, we don't see God. God remains beyond the direct grasp of our human faculties. Contemplative loving, therefore, occurs in the darkness of faith. Faith enlightens, yes, but it's a light that the intellect cannot receive. When we accept to be guided by faith, we're united to God and guided along the way inspired by God, though our intellect cannot see the path. God is leading us now on the way of love, learning to rely solely on faith. Can be, hopefully it's not, but it can be quite painful as we grieve for the kinds of meditation that we previously had and the pleasure they gave us. However, if we surrender ourselves to God, we will experience an even deeper and richer delight. I'm aware that a lot of this presentation, which I've now come to the end of, apart from the music, a lot of it it's my own words, struggling to try and make myself clear about all this and help you if I have helped you. But it's pretty dense. Probably because I don't understand it all that well. We're into quite mysterious places here. But maybe on reflection, some of that might help you. I think the key point of it, this contemplative darkness, the night darkness, is not to fear it, to realize that what we were getting pleasure from before, our meditations, our prayers, our liturgies and all of that, spiritual reading, all of it's good. But what was somehow making sense to us and helping us, and it had its place and it was wonderful, this change in direction of prayer isn't related to all that. It doesn't seem to be. And so it might cause us to be disturbed. It needn't. It's the night where we're protected, where we're enlightened, but at a deeper level than our normal senses and imagination and feelings and emotions can give us. The next presentation will select the key element of all this, and that is faith. Let's conclude by hearing John of the Cross as sung. The words aren't exactly his. The poem itself is quite beautiful, but these words are put together, I think, quite beautifully. And it's the question we're asking maybe at this time of contemplative prayer. Where have you hidden, beloved? Because we can't see. Where have you hidden? Well, he hasn't hidden. It's just we've gone beyond what our senses, imagination, memory, feelings can attain.